conventions and conferences and planning sessions in that setting as administrative head is responsible for supervising university interns from college universities across the country. Then moving in July of last year to the University Without Walls program at Harvard University as director and coordinator of special programs. It's from the combination of these vantage points that she has, in addition to her education experience, assembled over 14 years of diversified experience in teaching, guidance, and administration, and supervision and leadership activities in innovative education programs, human relations, and human dynamics aspects of supervising these programs, program development, coordination. From these vantage points and with this background brings to us a very rich set of experiences and perspectives. And she addresses for us this morning and leads our thinking about the equal educational opportunity that brings our troubled water. It is my pleasure and privilege to present you this time. This is Anita Heath, acting for our speaker today.
While operating in earnest, but not really earnestly probing mere suggestion that the solutions have been overlooked. There are three points I'd like to bring to you. One related to policies, and I have likened them to educators. The point of elitism in education. The barriers that prevent equal educational opportunity, one of these. And then leading on, fourthly, to the possible bridge. Has not equal educational opportunity represented a bridge over troubled water? What then is missing, either through the sins of commission or omission? Not only that, have we really defined equal educational opportunity? Or even what bridge over troubled water? To paraphrase some of what Robert K. Merton concerned himself with in Discrimination and the American Creed, as discussed by Edward Ludwig in Fallacy of the Symbolic Solution, educators are limited in effective action by several fallacies to which an educator is particularly prone. I suggest to you the fallacy of group soliloquy, the fallacy of unanimity, and the fallacy of privatized solutions. The fallacy of group soliloquy is one in which I dare say some well-meaning educators seek each other out for meeting on significant topics. You're familiar with the weakness that educators possess of talking to themselves and thus support each other socially and psychologically. The aforementioned leads me to the fallacy of unanimity. I ask you, if that same group of educators continues to associate with each other, would they not be inclined to assume some sense of consensus related to their views? Or better yet, be lulled into an illusion that a large measure of consensus has been achieved in the community at large? We then led to the fallacy of privatized solutions, demonstrated by the contentment with which the group views and behavior indicated that there is no need for solutions of any problems because the house is in order. Perhaps there's disagreement here related to the suggestion of the existence of any such fallacies on the part of the educators, I dare say. However, it cannot be denied that traditional and non-traditional study must invest itself even more to solutions. Nonetheless, we are assembled here discussing issues which are not only awesome in scope, but complex in execution, but also not so beyond the 1972. The case in point witnessed the topic of equal educational opportunity, which for all purposes and intentions, which for all intents and purposes, excuse me, for generations has manifested itself as a bridge over troubled waters. Now, I don't know whether there are those of you familiar with those three fallacies, but would you entertain now some discussion as to whether there is any agreement on the fallacy of or the fallacy of unanimity, or the fallacy of privatized solutions on the part of educators? Would you submit to that? What's your response at this moment? You start out rather cold. What's this lady going to say? Am I going to disagree with her? Where is she coming from? Hand on my chin, on my nose. What gives here? Why am I here? Why are you here? Do you know? Are you here because it happens that someone made your way? Are you here because it's an adventure? Are you here because it is convenient to talk to people who are just like you? challenge would you have if, let's say, the Chamber of Commerce were here this morning? Or let's say the American Association of Television Writers were here? What's your reaction if you were the speaker here and whereas ahead of time you knew that your speech was going to be taped, but did you know that someone in the audience would also be taping it? What are the aims? Have I provoked any thoughts? I see some smiles on some faces. I see some smirks on others. I see protoplasm elsewhere. But think about it. Robert Merton happened to have been talking about liberals. I like it.
Provide at the federal level an equal education.
educational opportunities through funds for the following as defined in that Senate bill. Student aid, direct learning loans, college work study programs, education opportunity grants, guaranteed student loans, student loan marketing association, basic education opportunity grants, upward bound talent search and special services, which were mentioned by speaker yesterday, grants to states for state scholarship, institutional aid. Not to discuss economic barriers as they relate to equal educational opportunity is analogous to a cart without a horse. Therefore, no discussion of non-traditional study should omit dollars and cents, spelled either C-E-N-T-S or S-E-N-S-E. Student protests, demonstrations, drop-ins, and even drop-outs, disenchantment with the system, have attested to the fragility and the vulnerability of institutions of higher education. One of my friends has gone to sleep now. Someone else, I suppose, would just be considered resting their eyes. My word, where are we as education? Educators. Higher education intervention models pervade our academic setting. Few models, as you well know, are community colleges, metropolitan state colleges in the summer, open education districts, Empire State, and the University Without Walls. None of which is perceived as a panacea, or would you believe, a bridge? Having agreed earlier that it is at the level of higher education that knowledge is truly disseminated, and given the factors representing unrest, we must conclude that perhaps there is merit in some of the above arguments. Let us discuss for a moment the University Without Walls, particularly since I am somewhat familiar with it. It can be viewed, you know, as a bridge over troubled waters. Well, it certainly does allow a second chance woman who chose a husband and children at an early age, or Vietnam veteran who elected to interrupt his college education, or the man who neglected his business, or the young woman who did not repent, or the man with a high school dropout for a supervisor, all who wish for an alternative coach to an adventure. The University Without Walls, however, is a member of the consortium of 22 colleges and universities across the United States, which accommodate University Without Walls programs under the Union for Experimenting Colleges coming out of Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. It doesn't have the usual spatial or temporal limits, and it doesn't consider the classroom to be the principal instrument of instruction. But I think in terms of spatial and temporal limits, I'm suggesting that as space is concerned, you need not enroll the courses in the host institution, nor need to have the confines or the constraints of freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year. The program is designed for the self-directed, well-motivated students, encompassing broad citizenry of ages, backgrounds, and interests. For the classroom, utilization is made in the city, the nation, and the world. Students develop at their own pace. Rationale for this alternative approach, and I recently not this as a fantasy. Consideration has been given to a new direction in education based on studies related to protests, dropouts, and I consider the drop-ins. Well, so many students are just that, drop-ins, and they too deserve our attention. If we consider each individual miracle, we must treat each individual as though we truly believe in this miracle. In the words of Mamie T. Gere, an applicant for the program, in response to why I no irrelevant test. Unnerving, scattering my mind. Only guidance, work, salvation, I find. This was written by a 67-year-old woman with a BA and an MA who wanted to enter the university without the law because it wasn't an alternative approach, and she wanted to write a saga of her people as her new contribution. During the early stages, its very nature as a special program dictated that it is much as planning and developing were vital. Autonomy was needed for developing procedures which are indigenous to the University Without Walls. And none of these programs can proceed unless they are given some autonomy. In response to the aforementioned disenchantment, listed below are a few of the objectives that people of White Island suggested the other evening that perhaps it would be wise not to set goals and objectives at the outset. Here are a few. Bear in mind now that some of these objectives were espoused prior to the inception of the University Without Walls. This, however, does not mean they are espoused. To affect an atmosphere in which there is a mix of learning activities to encompass the classroom, workshops, internships, seminars, independent study, while fostering in this decade a more humane approach, individual learner, with a curriculum germane to the needs of all students, to generate an occasion a new breed of faculty who listen as well as lecture, and who perfect instruction. To create a faculty outside of the book regular for the faculty to teach new specialties, work in concert with the regular faculty, to enhance the learning process for students, to serve as a springboard for students to offer a noteworthy contribution, which is not only agreed and worked, but also valuable to their fellow men, to progress. To broaden the learning resources with and for students to include untapped business, industry, and government. To encourage strong emphasis on student direction and self-motivation, which will nurture, if you will, a lifelong learner, and not as so many have become, finished products. I indicated earlier that I would rather be with you as opposed. However, I notice that even with some of the polite listening to which we have all become accustomed, I don't see any evidences of an exchange at this point. If you would like to interrupt and ask me a question as I'm moving along, I'd be most happy to respond. Are there questions at this moment? Primarily, the students who have enrolled in our University Without Walls are older, close to 20 years. They have some experience and have pursued some postgraduate studies. 50 students, 53 precisely, are currently enrolled. And they're pursuing degrees in the College of Liberal Arts, the College of Fine Arts, the School of Engineering, the School of Communications, and the School of Business and Public Administration. One student, or rather genius student in the pilot program, who at the outset indicated that he would like to prove the worthy thesis of the University Without Walls. He was sponsored by his company and made a three-week trip to Europe as a follow-up on Metropolitan Studies, sponsored by American University. The purpose of the trip was to ascertain methodology used in dealing with urban problems, and in particular, European cooperatives. He intended to use this exposure to develop a comparative analysis of U.S. cooperatives. Focus is on social institutions. This project will be one of a three-part module. He proposes to use reference materials of his study in social science. The academic community thus far at Howard has been gracious assisting us with the 30-odd advisors who have welcomed this new challenge. It is our hope to weave within the fabric of the university, not to come separately. In such such a manner as to not only further foster a rich learning experience in our women, but also serve as a catalyst for continuous change. Eugene Dinah, one of our pilot students, will offer these pertinent thoughts. It happens that Eugene Dinah completed our program with a grant of his degree from the College of Liberal Arts, having done a study in art history on the comparison of Lion and Channel art. He said at the outset of his program that he was in a hurry. At 71, he didn't have much time. And he became 72 this past August and wanted to know from me if I thought it wise for him to enter graduate school. And he said that the reason why he wanted to close the door to my office, the reason why he wanted to know whether he should enter graduate school or not, because it's quite real, he didn't think that that's what he wanted to do. But if I gave him some advice, if I suggested to him to enter graduate school, he thought it really was to teach him. He said, the most important feature of University Without Walls, which I contemplated upon the participation, was the individually tailored curriculum. This still remains the dominant appeal, in my opinion. Now that I have earned a Bachelor of Arts degree that I wanted at Howard University, but it seems to me that the success of such an individually structured program depends primarily upon two decisions. One, that the candidate's motivation, however good, is matched by his capacity to execute this program. And two, that the appointed advisor's competence be matched by his sympathy and understanding of the basic University Without Walls philosophy. The latter seems crucial to me, he says, he goes on. Especially in the case of the less aggressive, the advisor's function is not so much to arouse interest as to sustain the individual's determination to execute successfully each step in his march toward his objective. Unquote. We have had some spin-offs at Howard, one relating to a hookup with the government of the Virgin Islands. We have a hookup currently with the District of Columbia Correctional Department, and we've been approached by the Community Mental Health Association as well as Pride Incorporated. So there are other avenues in which you can become involved in a program such as this day. Question. What then is perceived?
Now, for instance, the Mount Royal I know that they were internships and field work, and I know they do some work in the mail. But they do work on campus, and what kind of things is possible in the academic school?
Right, now the mix runs the gamut. There is no correspondence work involved here. This is truly people, not paper. And I've said this to a couple of other people who've asked me questions this week. In no way whatsoever is this considered as we have organized it. In no way whatsoever is it considered paper or correspondence. It is truly people. All of our students are required, and this is indigenous to our program. This is not a requirement of other programs. This is one of the reasons why, as I introduced the material, I did not mention other programs except to say that there was a consortium. You may very well ask someone in another institution, and the answers will be totally different. But it so happens that our students are required to come to the university to spend the day once a month. And there is an all-day seminar planned. For the reason that we feel three or four things related to it. One is the fact that students who are entering upon this type of a program in which they plan their own contract with the assistance of an advisor truly need supportive services. And if they do not come to the university at all, then they are left floundering. When they do come to the university for the seminars and are able to exchange ideas related to where they are in time, how they arrived at that point, what kinds of problems they have, they offer a support for each other. And oftentimes we find that in those seminars, there isn't even the need for a leader, as it were, or a convener of the seminar, because the students take this upon themselves. And as I said, ours simply happen to be, by chance, mid-career people. As for the kinds of programs which they pursue, we have I have a 19-year-old student who needs some assistance in the basics, reading, writing, and computing, as I say. It happens that at this moment he is involved in the social, in this particular study period, he is involved in a social science course, an English course, and a math course. Now, this for him would be considered a traditional program in terms of courses. But I dare say that in weaving through the fabric, we do not negate the traditional, because you see, you cannot function if you are not, in fact, you do not have those basics related to reading, writing, and computing. And I think it's foolhardy to even allow a student to believe that he is equipped and can continue without having the firm foundation. It happens that he's interested in engineering, and he thought that in as much as he had spent 1.5 months studying, that the next time he would just indicate to me that he wished to pursue the engineering. And I talked with him, counseled him, and was able to have him understand this. Now, I have two students who, I think it was Howard Walker, I'm not sure, who suggested, no, it wasn't, but Ed Kielbach, who suggested to me last night that you really need to have students who can support themselves academically in order to be able to prove that this kind of an alternative approach will succeed and is valid in the life of a student. And I agree, but suggest it. Nonetheless, it's really incumbent upon us to offer the opportunity to other students in order to be able to prove that an alternative approach can work for students, irrespective as to where they find themselves. Now, we have other students who are, we have one student who happens to be employed in a bank. And you see, what he's doing there is using part of the time, part of the time in which he's involved in the bank and supervised by a banking officer, he's using that as an internship. And you see, the students are allowed the opportunity to select segments and put them together so long as they are valid and related to their stated goals. You see, the students are at various levels depending on where they were when they first entered the program. If, in fact, someone has come in with multiple experience, as it were, and it does in fact relate it to their goal, they are given credit for the past experience so long as they can document and validate it. It's not, I said I did so-and-so, but they're able to validate. And in cases where you will find some older students who have to have a woman who's 55, and she's a mental health therapist, and she's in the area of art. If it happens that someone who was participating in her life, as it were, somewhere along the way, is no longer with us, you see, it's rather difficult for her to be able to document a given experience. And so understandably, in that individual case, you would not require the kind of documentation that would be provided for otherwise. And it would be unfair, you see, not to give her credit so long as she can, if she can write it in such a way to make it understandable to an advisor who has the expertise in her field, you see. Or, in addition to that, she can prove a competence. Whatever manner he suggests, and the advisors are, I'll get into that, I want to be sure that I answer. Did I answer all of the aspects of your question?
One aspect I'd like to ask, well, this young man working at the bank, let's say he was prompted by some advanced accounting procedure. He can't go to the accounts to take the course.
Yes, he can.
Well, but suppose he can't, suppose he's limited, right? Can he go at night, is that it?
Yes. Or he can have a tutor, you see. Or we make arrangements for release time.
Or could he study by himself and then go to the campus and take the examination?
Yes, he can do that. Accounting needs a good bit of attention, however. Other than that, that's not one of the kinds of things that you can cover on your own. Yes. How do you perceive administrative role as related to advisory here?
facilitator, possibly as a project records keeper.
He's not a records keeper. The student is responsible. He's given the documentation process, and the student is responsible for seeing that those records are kept in order. The advisor's role there is to sign those. There are some forms in which he has to make some entries. But he doesn't have an administrative load, as it were.
You're talking about the possibility that this may open up a whole new professional dimension. In other words, the person who really puts his heart into this close relationship with the individual student is taking time for other things. How is he compensated aside from the intangible? I think we all understand.
I think those intangibles sometimes are sufficient.
Well, you haven't answered my question.
Oh, I'm suggesting to you. No, I'm not suggesting to you. I am saying to you that in our experience, the rewards are in assisting in a new venture in the life of a student.
Well,
there are no monetary benefits accrued here. I don't know that I'm reading all that you're saying.
I want to know how to rip off one third time from a Nobel laureate for nothing.
Well, that depends on that Nobel laureate, you see.
We're already doing it. The really good guys are Kurt Parker, the old professor of PhD in his 40s and 50s, and most of them beat him.
Yeah.
But the new assistant professor kind of thought.
Now, I have some new assistant professors working with us.
I don't like to generalize. Their acceptance to everyone.
Yes, and they have
guys that have suggested to me the answers to the kind of nitty little line problems. I intuitively know the answers, but I want to find somebody who's already been the room.
Why should you shy away?
There isn't a question of shying away from paying the person. It's a question of the mechanics of it. We have some institutions. I was talking to my host here, as it were, this morning about the planning of his program, and he said that he had been given either 2 or 3 years to plan the program at Ottawa, and I didn't comment to him at the time. We didn't have that advantage in terms of planning. I came aboard in July of 71. I was asked at what point did I believe that we would be able to take in students, and I said that my guess would be January of 72. There was a suggestion to me, how about September of 71? So, you see, for that reason, that's one of the mechanics, that of the release time and the question of a monetary reward are problems that we really have not solved. It just happens right now that we're very, very lucky in terms of the advisors, and they are crucial. The program, or any program in these circumstances, would fold immediately if those advisors elected not to participate in the manner in which they have. It's a very not a problem. Him. There are no questions asked. You do not have to go to him and ask him. But the very fact that you see, he has the list, he knows he knows what's taking place. And then I always forward to the heads of the departments and the names of the various schools, the names of the advisors who are assisting the students in the area in which they are involved. And I imagine that in some quiet way it might play a role. Oh, yes.
Contract.
Yes. Each student develops a contract.
question was whether or not that is happening in the traditional program.
No, that is not currently happening in the University of Florence. No, it is not. Hopefully that will be one of the changes that may be effective in the Gillespie College. Yes? That depends on where the, how the advisor happens to feel about it at that time. If he's able to accept it as it is presented, or if he feels that there's some question and there ought to be some demonstrated competency, then there is. It's open.
Okay, by what authority then can the counselor accept this experience and award a certain amount of credit?
That is an authority which is given to him as an advisor through the advisory committee of the University Without Walls.
So once a counselor determines that a student has this amount of credit, that's it, there's no further questions?
No, there's no further questions. As long as he's able to support it through his department and college. Now, they raise some questions about it. You see, there may be something else he would have to do, but he has the authority to do that. Yes. No, there are no grades given. You're given satisfactory or incomplete. That is, excuse me a moment. The satisfactory and incomplete apply to the seminars, internships. For the regular courses, as an example, the young man whom I said was taking the three courses, he would receive grades, you see, because his coursework is done through the regular university, and he would have a transcript which would read as a regular transcript does. But our transcript, which we will be submitting in conjunction with the regular transcript when there's a case of a transfer or a move to a graduate school, you see, is in the narrative, the descriptive form, and there it is requested as satisfactory. The student is allowed the privilege to have that incomplete change to a satisfactory. You see, at a given point, he's always given credit for as much as he's done, as opposed to having a scale from A through F, and if you get 59, you fail, for instance. But you haven't received any credit for the 59 that you already know is worth. That would alter the scale as it relates to climate. I had not considered it. It never occurred. Thanks for asking. I'll keep that in the back of my mind. Yes. kind enough to repeat that.
Department and maybe a county dean's office to approve what he did.
There is one main advisor, but most students have a team in which there are other people involved in the process other than the advisor. I simply said the advisor because that's the person ultimately responsible. As I talked about the departments and the dean and the colleges, you see when it's degree granting time